Tonight is a very, 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 very special night for me because, as you saw and heard, many of these birthdays and some of the people that are taking birthdays tonight is people that been influenced by the man that you're going to hear tonight that influenced me and influenced some of the guys that call me sponsor. And then some of the guys that call them sponsors. So it just goes all the way down the line. It's a pretty long, branched out big tree. And you probably don't know it until you hear it out while you out. If you hear some of these other guys speak, they'll tell you, you know, why and how and who helped them get there. So for me, I just can't tell you what this gentleman has done for me. I mean, I got to sit with him through all kinds of things. I sat with him at the, you know, at his wife's bedside when she passed away. He's been with me through anything and everything I've ever had to go through. So I'm going to shut up, stop talking, and introduce the man who's guided me all these years, my sponsor, over 30 years, Bob Lahan.
Thank you for having me, Willie. Seems like it's just a couple of days ago that we were doing the same thing here. But anyway, I'm grateful to be in Al-Anon and grateful to be here at your meeting.
This is Willie's.
Hello? I came to Al-Anon when I was 43, and that was 55 years ago. And I was taught never to keep... always keep coming back, and that was the motto that I learned early. But it was in Al-Anon I learned the principles of living. And this all started out, of course, with an alcoholic wife. So sometimes we think that maybe this Al-Anon program has to do with alcoholism. I think it has to do with living through alcoholism. And it was through my wife's alcoholism that I came to Al-Anon. So I always say that I'm grateful I was married to an alcoholic. Had I not been married to an alcoholic, I might not have been I might not have found this program here, which has changed my life. This all started quite a number of years ago. One thing that that happened quite a number of years ago. My wife and I were up at Vancouver, Canada, at a convention. We were speaking up there. And we thought, well, hey, let's make a vacation out of it. So we took a week off and went up there, rented a car, drove around all the islands and everything. And then it was time to check into the hotel, which was a 5-star hotel, by the way. Goldine was sitting out in the car while I went in to make the arrangements. And afterwards, I walked back to the car and I told Goldine, I said, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be experiencing things like this. And she said, well, I knew someday you'd appreciate me. But I did learn to appreciate my wife, you know. The program that I have found in Al-Anon is based on the 12 steps. The purpose of these 12 steps, I found one purpose in those 12 steps. And that is in the 12th step where it says, having had a spiritual awakening, tried to carry this message to others. Many people misquote that. They say we carried the message. It does not say that. It says we tried to carry the message. My purpose is to try to carry the message. I'm responsible for the results. God is responsible for I'm responsible for the effort, and God is responsible for the results. It also says, having had a spiritual awakening. I didn't know what that was. However, I tried working the program, and it's about 7 years, I had what I call my first spiritual awakening. It was not a spiritual experience. It was awakening of my consciousness. And what it was, a following meditation, just a simple realization that everything's okay. Now, I can always fall back on that whenever things seem to get out of order, when things don't seem to be going the way I'd like them to go, is that deep down realization, hey, it's okay. It's okay. Stop fighting it. It's okay. When I was in the program about 10 years, I had my second spiritual awakening. It came about the same way and has never left me. And that is that every experience is a spiritual experience. Everything that I go through has some sort of meaning to it. It has been brought into my life for a purpose. And from that, I came to realize that there is something directing my life. There is something that is coming into my life on certain through certain experiences, and these experiences have some sort of meaning for me to learn from. Now, if it's traumatic, maybe sometimes it's hurtful, and if I keep repeating the same thing, I keep getting the same answer there of the pain. So my experiences then are my teachers, and my teachers are primarily members of Al-Anon who I talk to on a daily basis. And this makes life pretty simple for me. I've learned a lot, I've gone through a lot of experiences. And one of the things that I learned, there are certain principles that Al-Anon has taught me that are unchangeable. They are, I'm sorry. There are certain things that I have learned. And one is, I'd love to say yes when asked to do things in Al-Anon. And the principle of saying yes then opens up a floodgate of new experiences and new learning things. When I say no, I close the door on the on what God is trying to teach me. One of the things that we always come into Al-Anon with is problems. And I was telling Willie one time, he was talking about issues. When I grew up, we didn't have issues, we had problems. But Willie was talking about an issue he had. And I said, Willie, get rid of two words. Get rid of the words issues and problems and replace them with the words opportunities and experiences. So sometimes he called me, he says, I want to have a issue I'd like to talk to you about. and with it then, always within it is some sort of a meaningful thing. I was down in Louisiana one time, and I was speaking at a convention down there. And a woman wanted to talk to me about some issues or problems that she had. So I said, well, let's have breakfast tomorrow morning. You can tell me all about it. Mm-hmm. So we met for breakfast. She ordered her breakfast, which was some eggs and toast. And she had this piece of toast, which she had her elbow on the table and holding this piece of toast in front of her, telling me all about her problems. And I was listening. Finally, she got excited, and she started saying, Bob, what should I do? I said, Bob, what should I do? And with no hesitation, I said, why don't you eat your toast? Now, the principle of that is, in the now, there is always something we have to do, and all problems are never in the now. All problems are either in the past or the future, but never in the now. So this is something that I learned about problems. And this all started back in 1943. I was going to, entered the Naval Aviation Cadet Program to become a Navy pilot. And the first assignment was to a small college in Southeast Nebraska. And it was there I learned to fly the Piper Cub. And also it was there that I met my future wife. This was at a college dance where we had been invited as a cadet. I asked her to dance and she refused. Fortunately, I asked her a second time, she agreed. So I was there for about, maybe a month or so, and then got orders up to the University of Utah of the Salt Lake City and for some more flying and ground school. And I kept in touch with Golding by mail, not too much telephone. And then I went to pre-flight school over in Monterey. And following pre-flight, I went down to Oklahoma at the University of, near the University of Oklahoma. And from there, I went on down to Corpus Christi, Texas. And I got down to Corpus Christi, Texas in early 44. And I was going through advanced flight training when Golding came down to visit me. As a naval aviation cadet, I was not supposed to be married. I could not have gotten in the program had I been married. If they ever found out that I was married, it was an automatic washout. But one night over a bottle of vodka of her up there in her hotel room, and with another couple who on the sly had gotten married, we had, it was there that this other couple who had gotten married on the sly thought it would be nice if Goldine and I got married. So we agreed to get married. And this other woman worked for a judge in Corpus Christi, Texas. And she called him that night, a Saturday night, said that Golding and I wanted to get married. So the judge said he would find the minister and we'd get married the next day. And that's what happened. On Sunday morning, we got married. And I always tell that story to tell you the power of alcohol and sex. You put those two things together and anything can happen. And that's what happened. However, I wanted to be a Navy pilot, and my higher power protected me from getting found out. I was never found out that I had gotten married. But that Sunday, I had to go back to the base, Golding found an apartment, and we started our life of drinking then. Every sixth or seventh day, I'd have a day off. And every sixth or seventh day, we'd do the same thing. We'd get a bottle, go out to a honky-tonk, dance, have lots of fun, and et cetera, and et cetera. And this continued then from age 20 up to age 43 until I came into Al-Anon. I got my wings there and became a Navy pilot in July of 43. And July of 44 it was. And I had volunteered for what we call a combat team to be a replacement group in the Pacific. The attrition was pretty high at that time. And so they were sending out groups to replace them. And so I volunteered for one and got priority orders and training from there on into the Barbers Point, Hawaii. And I was there about 2 or 3 months. Then I got orders to Guam. And from Guam, I boarded a destroyer and went out to Task Force 58. And I boarded the carrier, the Bella Wood, via a breeches boy. They didn't have helicopters at that time. So they'd transfer people by throwing a line between the two ships and put a pulley on there and pull me over. I had 3 or 4 operations of transferring from a destroyer to the carrier, or to a carrier. And one time they couldn't keep the lines taut and they drug me in the water. And so that was one of the exciting things. But I had a couple of experiences when I was on the Bella Wood. When I was a young boy, about 16, 17, I was at a youth group at church, and I started expressing some of the thoughts I had regarding spirituality. And a boy my age turned around and he said, "You can't think like that." my thoughts were contrary to the teachings of the church. I knew something was the matter with me. And I kept silent on that all the time until I came into Al-Anon, where Al-Anon says, find your own God, you know? So it was in Al-Anon that I changed my thoughts regarding God. I remember before a mission, the chaplain would have services. And I would never join that service because I thought it was kind of hypocritical to be asking for spiritual help at that time when I had no belief beforehand. However, whenever I made a safe landing aboard that carrier, whatever that hook caught, I'd say, thank you, God, to a God I didn't understand. So I had a belief system going all the time. Without my knowing it, I couldn't identify it. When I got out of the service, and I had always wanted to go to college. And so I started going to a small college in Sioux City, Iowa, where I grew up. And all this training that I had gotten had given me credits, college credits. So I got through college very, very rapidly. But again, there was always the drinking. I was going through on the GI Bill, gave us $75 a month. We always had enough to buy booze and party, always. And I got out of college, went to work for a small firm of General Motors, and it was an inside job. And going to work at 8:30 and getting off at 5, I couldn't stand it. So I left there to get an outside job. I started selling insurance, but I was afraid of talking to people. So I wasn't making much of a success in selling insurance. So I thought maybe I better go learn how to talk to people. So I joined Toastmasters Club, a speaking club. And I stayed with Toastmasters for 60 years, going to a meeting every week. Mm-hmm. But it was in 1952 that I decided to go back into the Navy. So I went back there for a 2-year enlistment. And again, big party. And part of the partying then was we had moved to Long Beach. Our squadron was stationed near there. And it was there that we bought a house and decided to stay in California after I got out of the service. For about 2 or 3 years, I jumped from job to job to job. I didn't know what I wanted. But yet, without my knowing it, the thought of this spiritual life was still in the back of me. And I was not aware of it. But it was there that the alcoholism became very, very apparent in my wife. Now, it took me a long time in Al-Anon to realize that alcoholism is an illness, obsession of the mind, spiritual allergy, and I did not have that allergy. Though when she drank, she could not stop her drinking. And I, of course, as a good Al-Anon, tried to correct it. I corrected it by yelling at her, screaming, hiding the liquor, maybe pouring out the liquor, doing all those things. And it couldn't stop her from drinking. We had a next door neighbor, Frank and Jenny Honeycutt, both deceased. And we'd have parties over there. And one time I took a bottle over there on a Saturday night. And I said, let's save half of this for next week. And I couldn't understand why Goldine and Frank had to drink that bottle. But an interesting thing in Al-Anon, which is important for me, to understand that understanding is not the answered. That's an intellectual process. Acceptance is the answer, because that's a spiritual act. So I tried to understand why they drank, and I couldn't. And after a while, Frank got on the AA program. And Goldine thought that maybe she should go to AA. And I remember pounding on the counter saying, I'm not going to let her be an alcoholic, not knowing what an alcoholic was. But anyway, I did not support her. But regardless of what I said, Goldine decided to go to AA with Frank. Now, Frank was a good friend of mine, but he wasn't that good a friend of mine where he'd taken my wife out at night. What were they up to, you know? Goldine did not drink for about 60 days. And it suddenly dawned on her that AA was talking about total abstinence. But by that time, alcohol had become her life. She could not go without drinking. So she dropped AA and went back to her drinking. However, she also started going to AA but couldn't stay sober. So I was working for a two-man partnership at that time. And I was going to quit that job. And one of the partners found out I was about ready to leave, and he said, where do you want to go? And I said, I had a friend in a corresponding type of the business living in Riverside, and I said, Riverside. So we opened up a small business there, and that was in 1964. And we had about 3 or 4 months before we moved, and Goldine said, get off my back, leave me alone, and I'll stop the drinking. So here was a promise of the alcoholic. So I got off her back, knowing that when they got to Riverside, she'd stop her drinking. And we got to Riverside, nothing happened. She went back to her drinking, different hiding places, that was all. Same thing, same thing. After a while, she started going to AA speaker meetings, couldn't stay sober, but I thought maybe I should go to the speaker meeting with her. And I could really identify with the speaker and Goldine. And I'd give her that Al-Anon nudge, you know, listen to this. And she's giving me this go to hell type of a look. I'd go through the speaker's talk on the way home. And she'd give me this go to hell type look and be drunk the next day. And I couldn't understand it. And now during this period of time, we had good times. We had bad times. It wasn't all bad. But Goldie was trying not to drink, that she could not because of her allergy and her obsession. And we were talking about it one time. She had never had any responsibility outside of the house. She's always been the housekeeper. So we thought, give her some responsibility. So we put her on as just my secretary. I had, after about a year in Riverside, I had built an office under the house and was working from my home. And so she became my secretary. And the only thing that changed, instead of her being a drunken housewife, she was a drunken secretary. Nothing had changed. And I was gone in the field most of the time, handling claims. And our assignments came in by telephone. And I'd come back to the office in the afternoon. There'd be a bunch of scribbling on a paper. I said, what's this? She said, I don't know. And because she had always learned that alcoholics drank in the morning. And she didn't drink in the morning for a long time until she woke up with the shakes, realizing that she had to have a steady hand to be a secretary. So she started drinking in the morning to get rid of the shakes. And by afternoon, she was in a blackout. But how that business survived, I'll never know. It went on. And I was trying to work. I had an incident where I asked Goldine to leave the house. And she went down to Long Beach to stay with Frank and Jenny Honeycutt. And they gave her 24 hours of AA through meetings, and tapes, people coming in the house. And after about a week, Virginia called and said, once you come down and reconcile. So I went down and walked in the house. Goldie said she would never drink again. And Virginia said that time, said, had you ever thought of Elna? That's the way she put it. She didn't say, you ought to go to Elna. She said, had you ever thought of Elna? And I thought maybe Elna was some mean by which I could get her sober. So I agreed to go to Elna. And we went to a meeting down in Anaheim, Sunday, June 6, 1966. I didn't understand the thing they were talking about. I was the only man in that group of maybe 30 people. And the only thing I knew is that I felt better when I left. I haven't said a word, but I felt better when I left that meeting. And Virginia said, before you make up your mind, try 6 meetings. I agreed. So I agreed to go to Al-Anon. In Riverside, there was one Al-Anon meeting. And that was in conjunction with an AA meeting. And I started going there. After a while, by half a dozen meetings, it suddenly dawned on me. They were talking about me looking at me for defects and to stop talking about Goldine and her defects. And that enraged me. And it made me mad to insinuate that I had that problem. And I went to a meeting over in San Bernardino on a Thursday night, I'll never forget it, to tell them off of what they could do with this Al-Anon program. And I rented an IRA for about half that meeting. And a gray-haired lady from Seattle, Washington was there, one meeting. And she looked at me and she said, Bob, you have a choice. You can be miserable or you can work this program. That entered my consciousness and has never left. I had a choice. I could be miserable, I could work that program. So it was then I became a member of Al-Anon. Rather than being around Al-Anon, I was a member of Al-Anon. And to be a member of Al-Anon, I had to start working those steps. The first defect of character that I recognized in myself was anger. During my life, I was angry at everything. I was angry at my wife, I was angry at our kids, angry at the traffic, angry at everything. And one Friday night at home, I got angry about something. I don't know what it was, very trivial thing, probably. And I started yelling and screaming, and I tore up their household. And the next morning, of course, I was full of guilt and remorse. And that Saturday morning, I said, God, don't let me be angry today. I didn't know what I was doing. All I was doing was asking for some spiritual help. And at the end of that day, I looked back at the day and I had not been angry. And I did that for a whole week. And for a whole week, I had not been angry. And that was a miracle in my life. And anger left me then, has never come back. It made me realize that there was something to this spiritual life. We had this one Al-Anon meeting that was at the back room of where the AA meeting was. And I would go down there and have to walk through the AA meeting to get the Al-Anon meeting. I was the only man there. And after a while, I became conscious of those AA eyes watching me as I went back to the Al-Anon meeting where the wives and sweethearts were. And it made me so uncomfortable. One night I was not going to go to that meeting because of what they thought. And then I thought, well, I feel better by going to Al-Anon. So I walked the gauntlet. I walked through that AA meeting watching all the eyes follow me. And I walked into the Al-Anon meeting, and there were 3 new men that night. And I learned the principle there, that there's something fearful for me. If I walk through it, there's always a reward. If I walk through my fears, there's a reward. I didn't know how it would happen, but I knew that that was a principle. And what was that?
Somebody's mic was unmuted. You're okay now.
Okay. But anyway, I started learning those lessons of what life experiences were trying to teach me in that AA meeting with a fellow by the name of John. And we got they got me on the board of the club there. I was the only Al-Anon member there. But John was there, and John and I didn't get along. Whenever I thought about John, I'd get this knot in my stomach. And one time, I complained about John. One time, a fellow said, "Why don't you pray for John?" I said, "Why should I pray for him?" I said, "Do you like the knot in your stomach?" I said, "No, I don't like the knot in my stomach." And said, "Well, you better pray for him." But I said, "I'll be damned if I will." But after a while, the knot in my stomach became more uncomfortable than praying for John. So I started saying, "God bless that SOB. God bless that SOB." And after a while, the SOB left. And I can sincerely say, "God bless him, God bless him, God bless him." And you know, the first thing you know, John started to change. And I went up to John one time. I said, "John, I sure have to pray for you, a lot for you." And he said, "Bob, I have to pray a lot for you too." What we were doing was using spiritual help to make amends. And John became a friend of mine. And he moved up to Northern California after a while. And at one time he became the program chairman of the convention. And he called me one of Goldie and I to come up and talk. Not only that, but to stay at their home up there in Northern California. Mm-hmm. So this is what this program can do. So I started recognizing some of those things. Goldie was still drinking. She was trying not to drink. We had it placed down in Ensenada, Mexico, and that we would go to on weekends. And Goldie was trying not to drink, but she couldn't stop from drinking. And we went down there one weekend, went over to some friend's house, and the first thing the host did was get a drink for my wife and a drink for me and sat him down on the table, arm's length from me, and right in front of Goldie. Up until that time, I would have prevented her from drinking. We would not have been around places that drank. We stopped going to those places. But something inside of me made me realize that was her choice and not mine. I was not in any manner trying to prevent that drinking. I was not physically involved. I was not mentally involved. I was not emotionally involved. I was not spiritually involved. I was a spectator wondering what's going to happen between that drink and Goldie. And I watched her struggle. I could see it in her face that she was trying not to drink. And finally, she reached over, she picked up that drink and she drank it. At that very instance, something happened in my pit of my stomach. I didn't know what it was, but it was a flash from my gut up through my head and out the top. I didn't know what it was for about 30 days. And I realized that was when I took the first step, when I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. And from that time on, I never tried to stop Goldie from drinking. I was free. But the important thing was she was free also. She was free to drink. I was free to allow her to drink. And the important thing is her drinking no longer bothered me. Her behavior bothered me at times. Her behavior bothered me. One time at an Al-Anon meeting, I was complaining about my drunken secretary. And a wise Al-Anon said, "If she was other than your wife, would you keep her?" I said, "Of course not." End of the conversation, but not the end of the thought. And I thought, if she was not my wife, I would have fired her. If she was other than my wife, I would have fired her in a moment for being drunk in the job. But I got to thinking about that. Why do I keep her as a drunken secretary? And one Friday night, we were going down to Mexico. And just before we left, I said to Goldie, I said, I don't care whether you drink, but not in this house. And if you're going to drink, you're going to have to leave the house. And with that, I fired her. And not knowing what had happened spiritually, one of the things for me and my consciousness, I had become willing to give up the marriage. And I have learned, for me to keep anything, I have to become willing to give it up. And that was it. I had to become willing to give up the marriage. Goldine at that time had to give up alcohol, had to surrender to alcohol. And it happened. She became sober at that time. But the important thing for both of us was that we turned to the program for our life and our spirituality. My program of Elohim became more important than the marriage to Goldine. And Goldine's relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous became more important than her relationship with me. But yet, in 45 years of her sobriety, I can't recall ever having any kind of an argument with Goldine. We were free. The program was working, giving us that peace of mind, as long as we didn't depend upon the other person for our happiness. Goldine was no longer the basis of my happiness, and I was never the basis of Goldine's happiness. And as a result of that, we could have good life. We started doing a lot of speaking at conventions. I think there's only two states in the universe that we had not spoken at. And this all started, first of all, when I was in the program about a year, year and a half, at the convention down in Anaheim, Southern California convention. A woman that I knew prior to the convention wanted me to participate in the convention. She was the program chairman. And I thought she meant put up the chairs and the ashtrays and things like that. But she said, no, I want you to speak on the 12th step at the Saturday afternoon meeting. And I said, no, I don't do things like that. I don't do things like that. And so she threw the hooker at me. Bob, we never say no to an Al-Anon request. So here I was called. I recall that when I was asked to speak in high school, I would always get sick. I always have to have somebody replace me. But here it was, I was sicker than a dog. And we had a motel over in Anaheim. And I was coughing, sneezing, flu-like symptoms. And thinking that maybe I would have to speak for 5 minutes in front of a crowd. And this terrified me. But finally, I decided I would do it. And I was up there on the stage with 11 other people, and to be the 12th speaker. In 5 minutes, I was coughing, was blowing my nose and sneezing, et cetera, et cetera. But 5 minutes before I was to speak, it all cleared up. And that taught me another thing. It taught me that my higher power was with me when I needed the higher power and not beforehand. I was always wanting the guarantee from my higher power of God that things would work out okay. I had to go through the trusting that it would be okay by just going through the thing. So this started me on my speaking career in Al-Anon. And also, I had become the group rep in my meeting in Riverside. And the Interdrift then was part of Los Angeles at that time. So I would go into Los Angeles on the Friday night to the group to the meetings, and came to realize that there was no way that people who wanted Al-Anon could find it in Riverside. And so I had helped started another meeting. There were two meetings in Riverside, and I said if each group would donate $10, I would start an answering service in our home, because I had rehired them, and they agreed. I think the telephone bill was $18, and we had $2 left over for literature and things like that, you know. But we would get calls in the middle of the night. Sometimes we'd get calls in the middle of the night and go make a 12-step call. Sometimes the family would leave the alcoholic and they'd come and stay with us for a while. Those things aren't done much anymore, but it was necessary then. And after a while, other groups started joining that entering service until finally there's about 30 of them. And we were getting maybe 100 calls a month. Goldie, by that time, had become delegate of AA. And I was trying to have a business and et cetera and et cetera. And I finally got contact those 30 groups and said for a meeting, said, what do you want to do with this answering service? I had been the chair of the LA Service Center I had been on the board for 5 years. And I knew a little bit about the intergroup. So I told these 30 people, I said, what we could do is start an intergroup meeting out here in the Inland Empire and maybe have an office. And nobody heard intergroup, everybody heard office. So everybody wanted to start, open up an office. I said, no, you can't do it without an intergroup. So they agreed to the intergroup. And we looked around and et cetera, and et cetera, and finally established a service center over in Colton, California, which still exists now. And we had our own intergroup. Other activities was I got involved in World Service, ultimately became the delegate. And then more important, after as a delegate, I had the position of the past delegate. Now, the only thing I could find out about being a past delegate is it gave me 3 years to learn to keep my mouth shut. And that was important. To become the listener and not the prosecutor. I was telling Jamie when she was elected, I said, your job is not to change Al-Anon. Your job is to let Al-Anon change you. And I noticed she has used that remark many times when she was giving a talk. You know? But that's But anyway, I became a spectator with the World Service and doing a lot of other things instead. One of the things that I did, when I was church hopping early in Al-Anon, thinking there's got to be something in churches. And I went to a church that was talking about some of the things that I felt during all my years. And it kind of coincided with that. And I started going to that and then found out that Chuck Chamberlain went to that church. I said, well, if it's good enough for Chuck, it's good enough for me. So I started going to that. And after a while, I started taking classes. I spent 2 years taking vocal classes. And then suddenly dawned on me, you had to have those 2 years before you go to Los Angeles and become a minister. And somewhere or other, I don't know how, I enrolled in that class in Los Angeles. And for 2 years, I drove back and forth, maybe four, five, six nights a week to go to ministerial school. A strange thing had happened in my business. The one business had said I could no longer handle the business. Another client moved their office from Riverside down to Orange County, so I stopped getting their claims. And so I was left with just a small portion of my business. So they kept saying, why don't you go make some promotional calls? But I just didn't want to. But what it did is it gave me time to go to ministerial school to fulfill all of my commitments in Al-Anon. I had become an Al-Anon sponsor. I was involved in SCAC and a lot of activity. A strange thing, I had my last class in Riverside on a Wednesday night. Thursday, this company that had dropped me 2.5 years previously called, wanted to know if I could start handling their claims again. Then another company that I was doing business with expanded my territory to include Orange County. So I got back all the business that I had to give up to go to that ministerial school. But then I became a minister. I was free to do things that a minister can do. And one time I got a call to come up to Newhall to do the Sunday morning sermon. And I went up there. My topic was Beyond Positive Thinking. The name of the church was the Positive Thinking Church of Newhall. And I thought, oh my God, I'm in trouble. But afterwards, they asked if I would be the minister. And I said, oh, no. A couple of weeks later, they again invited me up there to talk. And again, they asked me to be the minister. And I figured I'd be told something. So I said I would. So I became their minister for a year and a half. I told them I said I would be their minister, but Al-Anon came first, and they agreed to that. So at that time, then, I started doing a lot of weddings, a lot of memorial services, and all over the valley, the valley of Los Angeles, Orange County, et cetera, and which I would not have been able to do without a ministerial license. It was kind of interesting. But after a year and a half, I had that feeling it's time to leave. And so I gave them notice that I was going to leave. And it took about 6 weeks for them to find another minister. Mm-hmm. But that was my ministerial thing. Very early, and I hadn't mentioned this before, very early is when I was 6 or 7 years old, 7 or 8 years old. I had heard my grandmother tell my mother that someday Robert's going to be a minister. From my knowledge now of things, what I had done is put that into my subconscious mind, this is the doer, and it had to be done, and that became my priority for living. And I had become a minister, not only in a church, but also in Al-Anon. And so Al-Anon is my big ministry. And I had all kinds of things going. One of the things that I got the feeling one time that I should give up that business. And I thought, well, how am I going to survive? How am I going to survive? This thought persisted. And so I knew I was being told something. And one Saturday morning, I said, God, how will I survive? How will I survive financially? And that morning, on a Saturday morning, I went jogging. I lived at the edge of town. And I went up this trail. And ahead of me was a coyote. And he stopped. He didn't run. He stopped. And I stopped. We were looking at one another. I was admiring the way he felt. He looked. And I thought, my gosh, all the rabbits are gone. There's no water available. How does he survive? And then I realized he doesn't ask foolish questions like that. So I realized that was my answer. If I take that third step, I will be taken care of emotionally, physically, financially, in every manner. So I went home, and after they dismissed, I went home doling my spiritual experience with the coyote. She said, "So you saw a coyote," and she didn't understand at all. But based upon that, I walked away from that business. I did not even try to sell it. And strange things started happening financially. I worked with a central office. There was a little income. I had some stock, a particular stock when zooming up, I sold it enough to take care of a couple of months income and things like that. Even my former competitor of mine called and said, "What are you doing these days, Bob?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Well, I'm kind of overloaded with claims. Could you come and help out?" I said, "Sure." So I spent maybe 15, 20 hours a week working for him. But strange things happened that we were taken care of financially and have been taken care of financially. I have learned the principle of we always have enough. Most people want more than enough, but we always have enough of whatever. If I've taken that third step, I will always have enough time, ability, materialistic things, whatever. I'll always have enough. So we spent a lot of time in the program. Strange things started to happen. One time, when I was growing up in high school, there were four of us who were pretty close together. And after the war, we all split up and went different places. And I started thinking, I wonder what ever happened to Homer. Homer Johnson was one of them. And over the years, I wonder what ever happened to Homer. In 1979, Goldine, as a delegate, went out to Plaza in Hawaii. And the convention is going to be at the hotel up in the northern tip of Hawaii. But on the way up, we went through the Dole's pineapple display. And as we were leaving that to go out the parking lot to the car, a tour bus came up and started letting the passengers out. And they were flying, they were single file. We were single file going towards one another. And I caught this man's eye. And as we got up, he said, "Bob Lahan." And it was Homer Johnson. Now, you computer people, put that possibility in your computers and see what the possibility was of us meeting in Hawaii at that particular time to answer that question of whatever happened to Homer. But strange things started happening. There was another time. I had been going all this time through the Navy, staying with the Navy. I retired out of the Navy Reserve. And I was a weekend warrior protecting you folks from the Russian submarines on the coast here. But anyway, I finally stopped. I finally retired because they had taken away my flying billet. I was just not realizing that I had 20 years. So from those 20 years, I got a pension from the Navy. One time I told Goldine, I said, "Were you ever proud of the fact that I was a commander in the Navy?" She says, "Were you ever proud of the fact that I was a cheerleader in high school?" And I thought, oh, shit. But anyway, Goldine used to always keep me intact. I'd always work on that ego of mine. But anyway, that gave me the opportunity to do some space day flying in the military. The only cost for me was $1.50 for box lunch. I could fly free on the military aircraft throughout the world. So I did that. I spent a lot of time doing that. Goldine would go with me sometimes. We went to Hawaii many times out of March Air Force Base at that time. And went to Japan one time. went to Samoa a couple of times, and so we had a good time. Other than it was not totally Elton on an AA, but yeah, we always made time. AA and Al-Anon took priorities and everything. So as time went on, Goldie passed away 10 years ago. And I miss her very much. She was a great lady. We had a son also, alcoholic. He started his drinking when he was 12, 14 years of age. And he also went to Elatine, by the way. He went to Elatine. But the fact that he goes to Elatine does not prevent him from becoming an alcoholic. And after a while, when he was in his early 20s, we asked him to leave home. And so he went down to Long Beach to live. And after a while, he disappeared. We hadn't heard from him. And for 2.5 years, we did not hear from Steve. And thought, is he dead or alive? Is he dead or alive? And one day I thought, you know, I have a right to know, is he dead or is he alive? And I said, God, is he dead or is he alive? We had not heard from him for 2 years. And about 2.5 years later, about 2.5 weeks later, we get a letter from him saying, I'm alive and well. You've come back into Long Beach. But he had been over in Arizona, and over in Arizona, he picked up the AIDS virus. And we got a call from the doctor one time, said, if you want to see Steve alive, you better come down. I said, is it AIDS? And he said, yes. So Goldie and I cried all the way down to the hospital. And he was had all kinds of cords within him, et cetera, et cetera. Steve was gay, but we had never talked about it at home. And I brought the subject up. I said, Steve, I don't know, understand it, but it doesn't mean I don't love you. And this seems to give him a perk, because he totally lacked his self-worth all his life. But that gave him the perk. And they took him off the cords and put him up in isolation, gave him a lot of medication. And finally, both kidneys failed. And he didn't want any life support. And he was willing to go on. But he didn't want to die in the hospital. So I said, Steve, you want to come home? Yes. So he brought him home. He lived for 18 months. During those 18 months, he came home expecting him to die in maybe 2 or 3 days. His kidneys, both kidneys started functioning again. Doctors could not understand it, but we could. And he lived for 18 months, giving us the opportunity to make amends, both him for us and we for him. And after a while, there was one time he was in a coma. He'd been in a coma for about a week, about a day. And he woke up from that. And he said, what a place, what a place. He saw something that we could not see. And this was about 5 minutes before he passed away. I was holding on to one hand, Goldie was holding on to the other. And just as he passed away, Steve said, Steve, I love you, have a good trip. And with that, he was gone. We had a memorial service for him. Nancy, a member of AA, was a participant. Leading the memorial service, and she knew Steve, and she was crying. And I went up to her, and I said, "Nancy, it's okay." And it made me realize that it's better to give condolences than to expect the condolences. And I said, "This program really works." Mm-hmm. I might have time to talk a little bit about Barbara before the program. Barbara, my daughter, wouldn't mind me, and I gave her the choice of leaving. And she left home at age 16. And she married, she went down to San Pedro to marry, and she married a young man who drank a little bit, sure enough, an alcoholic. And she had 4 children. And one time some violence started, and she said, "Dad, can I come home?" And I said, "No, you can't. You can come home for a visit, but you can't come home to stay." Because I realized she was running from alcoholism one more time. She ran from alcoholism with her mother, and now she wanted to run from alcoholism with the husband. But as a result of that, she started going to Al-Anon. And I think she picked up some, but finally she became known as Bob's daughter, and that's when she left. And so I had a lot of guilt about what I had done. And I sat her down one time and I made amends to her. And I'm sure Bob forgave me. But that did not get rid of my guilt. And so I said, "God, get rid of my guilt." And the thought came then that I should become an Alateen sponsor. And I said, no. I don't like kids. The kids don't like me. But that thought persisted. And I became an Alateen sponsor. And the guilt left. And the guilt left. So what I do is I rely upon this program for all of my needs here. Again, I still have defects of character that I'm trying to get rid of. I have a saying that I'm available and let God find me usable. That's I get up in the morning and say, "God, I'm available. You find me usable." And apparently, after 98 years, I'm still available. I'm still usable in some manner. One thing I always like to close on is I was taking Godin's inventory one time and I realized she had never made amends to me. And I thought, how can she be comfortable? How can she be sober? So finally, I thought, you know, let her work her program and you work your program. So a couple of years went by and I walked into the kitchen one time and she was reading the AA Grapevine magazine. And as I went by, she said, "Bob, have I ever made amends to you?" And I thought, oh, here it comes. I knew this was going to take a long time for her. And I said, "Don't interrupt her. Get comfortable." I folded my arms, backed up against the kitchen counter, and I said, "No, you never have." She says, "I'm sorry," and she went back reading her book. that's the biggest thing. But as a person, she changed. Thank you. I see my time is up. So thank you for having me.